David versus Goliath. I mean, who does not know this story? It's a very, very famous story. Who can't benefit from it? Because we all face giants, as it were, foes that seem formidable. But when you study the life of David, you understand as a Christian how to face those foes to gain victory and to give God glory. But to understand this chapter 17, and since it's been 2 weeks since we were in this book, it's good to review. So we want to review in case you might have forgotten what was in chapter 16. Chapter 16 was about King Saul lost his kingdom because of his insubordination, his lack of faith in God. And so God took the spirit away from Saul and gave it to David, and anointed David. And so David is going to rise to power, and we're going to see him rise to power starting in chapter 17. God doesn't ever do anything quickly, and so it's going to take many years for David to become the king. But here you see God transitioning him to be the king. David has also played the harp, played it very well. And what we saw in chapter 16, somebody knew of his abilities, and so he got a gig playing for the king to comfort the king because the Lord sent a spirit to torment him and to discipline him for his lack of insubordination. And so God dealt with Saul, but David was brought into his quarters to comfort him. So that was not by accident. So everything that's going on in your life that seems that's disconnected is very connected in God's providence. So what we see in this chapter, chapter 17, is how God begins to bring his king to the throne. And it's going to be a chapter of contrast. There's the contrast between the giant warrior and a teenager. A total mismatch on the battlefield. It's a contrast between heavy weaponry and really no weaponry, as so to speak. I mean, a sword and a massive giant against a kid with a slingshot and a staff. Unbelievable. It's about a man with mocking defiance of God and a young man who was humble and courageous in his following hard after God. And so the whole chapter builds with tension. And so the author, as he put this together, as I told you, builds the tension to verse 32, where he breaks the tension by showing you what God had prepared David to do. And as you study what God did through David, it's your story. What's God doing in your story? Is he's moving through the mundane things of your life to position you to deal with a formidable foe. So to understand this chapter, we have to move through the panels of the historical development of it. And that starts in verses 1 to 10 that I would call the conflict, the battle between the Philistines and the Jewish army. And what you have here is the Philistines, kind of hard-headed people, didn't quite get the figure that the Israeli God was bigger than their God. Because remember back when we first started studying this book, when they captured the Ark of the Covenant and they hauled it off to their cities, and they put it before the Temple of Dagon, and they got up the next morning, and what happened? Dagon is gone. He did a face plant in front of the Ark of the Covenant, and they moved it around, and God afflicted them with a malady, a physical malady. I didn't tell you at the time what God afflicted them with, but he gave, wherever they took the Ark of the Covenant, the people in that town got hemorrhoids. That's what happened. God afflicted them all. No wonder they wanted to get it out of town. And so they get this ark out of here, send it to the next town. And eventually they just put it on a cart and just sent it to Israel. Get it out of here. But they weren't too smart. I mean, they continually attack Israel. And so God keeps giving the ancient version of the IDF victories. So they have victories under God with his ark. They have victories under Samuel, and they have victories under Jonathan, King Saul's son, and they keep getting victories. And so when you get to this chapter, it's how is God going to take this little shepherd boy and make him the king? And that's what we find in verse 1. The Philistines are back at trying to wipe out the Jews and steal their land. Sound familiar? It's an age-old motif that will not be solved until Jesus arrives in Matthew 25, but that's in the future. Verse 1 is what we want to focus on. It says the Philistines were gathered, their armies for battle. And they were gathered in a place called Succoth, which belongs to Judah. And they encamped between Succoth and Azekah in a place called Ephes Damim. And Saul and his men were gathered encamped in the valley of Elah. And they drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines, who were approaching from the south. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. I've been in this valley many times, and I've taken 20-something years of photos here. I'll only show you a couple of them. Here's one picture standing. There's a two-lane road behind me, But I hiked down to the Valley of Elah. So this is looking east toward Jordan. And on your right-hand side is this beautiful hill covered with trees. The Philistine army would have been assembled on that particular hill. If you pivot and you look to the left, this was taken at another time when there's actually greenery there. This hill was on the side where the Israeli army would have been encamped. So between them is a valley. How big is the valley? I'll show you with this aerial photograph. I did not take this. Someone must have flown a drone or something. So I'm borrowing what I found on the wonderful internet. So here's the road system I told you about. This is coming up from southern Israel, going down that way is toward Kadesh Barnea, and then Gaza is going to be over here. And this is the Valley of Elah, and this is the hill the Israelite army would have been on, and these are the armies, the hills that the Philistine armies would have been on. In between them is this little tiny valley. In your mind, when you're reading it, you're thinking, it must have been a big valley. When you get there, it's really small. So what that means is, from a military standpoint, these two massive armies with thousands of soldiers standing there can see each other. They can hear each other. So if you send a giant out there to mock the armies of the Israeli government, they can totally hear him and they can see him because the valley is not very big. And so the conflict is a setting of the story. Verse 4 introduces us to the psyops. It's nothing new. They were doing it in ancient times. They use this massive giant of a man to create fear and dread in the Israeli army. It says that their champion, the Philistine armies, came out. His name was Goliath. Where's he from? Gath. Goliath from Gath. How big was he? Well, it puts it in biblical terms, and I'll translate them over into modern equations so you understand just what is it telling you. So it tells you from a Hebrew perspective, his height was 6 cubits and a span. That helps me. He had a bronze helmet on his head. He was clothed with scale armor down the front of him. It weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had a bronze greaves on his legs. That would be the armor on his kneecap and below to guard his shins in a hand-to-hand combat. He had a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders, thrown over his back would be a huge javelin. And the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield carrier, that poor guy that had to carry that massive shield, also walked before him carrying that thing. So how big was Goliath? So if you study Goliath, he also had a brother who was big. David will deal with him later in his career. He would be like a remnant of the Anakim or the Zazumin or the Nephilim in the Old Testament if you want to study it. He's a remnant of those giants that walk the earth, like Og, king of Bashan in Deuteronomy chapter 3. But the size, you know, was menacing to the Israeli army. So how big was he? 9 feet, 9 inches tall. Would you want to do hand-to-hand combat against somebody of that stature? So his weight, who knows? I mean, 500-600 pound man, boom, boom, boom. Here he comes. His scale armor that went on the front of his body weighed 125 pounds. Now, I know the military special ops people among us are going, that's nothing. Well, 125 pounds, that's a lot of scale armor to be walking around with. His particular spear had an iron head on it that weighed 15 pounds. So you can imagine if you tried to throw that, I mean, it would be very difficult to get any like distance or accuracy out of it. So the man walking out into the battlefield, just his 9 foot, almost 10 foot stature would have just wreaked havoc in anybody that was watching him. It says in verse 8, he stood, and what did he do? It says he stood and he shouted in that little tiny valley at the ranks of Israel. And he said to them, why do you come out to draw up in battle array? I mean, what are we fighting for? Basically, am I not a Philistine and you are servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. So back in ancient times, when they did hand-to-hand combat, which we don't typically do today as much as they did then, they would send out their best warrior to fight on the battlefield. And if your warrior lost, then your nation lost. That way they preserve life and didn't have to do hand-to-hand combat. So this was not atypical. This was a normal thing between armies. He says, if he, your soldier, is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, you will become our servants and you'll serve us. Again, the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. Send me somebody. Send me your best soldier and we'll do hand-to-hand combat If I lose, you own the Philistines. If you lose, we own all of Israel. He did this, as we're going to read here in a few minutes. He did this for 40 days, twice a day. That's why I said it was PSYOPs. 40 days, two times a day. In the morning, you're having breakfast. Boom, boom, boom. Here he comes. Screaming and yelling. At dinner time, you're getting ready to have some whatever. Here he comes again. You got your falafel in your mouth. And it's that guy again. He's screaming, yelling. He wants this to send a soldier out there. Now, the problem with Goliath is he might have been big, but he wasn't too smart. Because he has a problem that the Israelis typically had as a people. He focuses on the external, not the internal. He focuses on the body size, not the courage size. So he has very limited viewpoints about reality. It's going to cost him, as we're going to see. Now, he came out with this giant challenge to the Israel's army. How did the Israeli army respond to him? Well, I call this, I can think of nothing better than the chickens. Here comes this almost 10-foot man, heavy armor, menacing warrior, screaming and yelling. And how did they respond? So the first verse and the last verse of this section, this is called, from a literary standpoint, it's called inclusio, I-N-C-L-U-I-S-I-O, inclusio. You use inclusio as a rhetorical device to capture what you want to talk about in a passage or a section. Here, the author wants you to think about the fear among the Israeli army. Because the first verse and the last verse talk about it. It says, when Saul and all of Israel heard these words from Goliath, the Philistine, they were full of great courage. No. They're rattling in their armor. They are greatly afraid. And then verse 24 says, when all the men of Israel saw this man, what'd they do? They did what? They fled. In the morning, you're having breakfast. Here he comes. I'm out of here, dude. I've heard this line before. At dinner, you're having dinner. Here he comes again. The soldiers are just running from the guy. Unbelievable. What they forgot is what God's word said. What did God's word say? Deuteronomy 31:8. Moses told them in behalf of God, it is the Lord who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you, which Jesus is going to say later to his saints. Do not fear or be dismayed. I don't care if the guy's 10 feet tall. I don't care if he's 8 feet tall. I don't care anything about physical size. Just do what I've asked you to do. Take on the foe. Joshua, when he goes to take the land of promise as God gave it to the Israelites, says, God tells him, have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened and don't be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Saul and his entire army forgot what God's word said as they faced Goliath. You have to stop and think about it on a side note. As you face your version of a foe like this, be whatever it is, have you forgotten what the word of God says? And you're fearful. And God's telling you this morning, stop fearing. I'm with you. I will go before you. You might have forgotten. So if you're on the run, running from Goliath, stop. Confess that you're fearful and say, God, help me to have great courage. Sandwiched in between these two statements of fear is an introduction to David. It says, verse 12, David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, his dad. He had 8 sons. Jesse was old in the days of Saul and advanced in years among men. And the 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to battle, so they fought as soldiers in the army. The names of the 3 sons, which we've heard before, Eliab was the firstborn, 2nd was Abinadab, and the 3rd was Shammah. David was the youngest of those sons. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from his Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem, because David was a shepherd. The Philistine came forward morning and evening, as I told you, for 40 days, and he took his stand. Now, you might look at yourself and go, I have the most mundane, boring job ever. Do you feel like that sometimes? It's like, I cannot believe what I'm doing. I mean, it's not what I planned on doing. David is a shepherd. I mean, he's out on the hillsides alone much of the time. And his dad asked him to take food to his brothers, 14-mile trek down the mountains from Bethlehem down to the Valley of Elah, and deliver food to his brothers, and to also come back and then do it again. Because they didn't have our version of MREs. You know what these are? If any church knows what an MRE is, this place. Now, if you're older, it was K rations, right? Remember those? And C rations in the cans and everything? Yeah, I've seen that. Seen these during Vietnam. So what's he doing? Well, they don't have a supply line of food like we do. So your family had to bring you as a soldier food. So David is doing this really mundane thing. You think he just happened to be doing this? No. Which tells you whatever mundane thing that is that you're doing could be the very thing God is going to use to position you to take on a formidable foe to do great things for God. So just think about what God's doing in your life. Jesse said to his son David in verse 17, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain, these 10 loaves, and run to the camp of your brothers. Bring also 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their thousand." So whoever the commanding officer is, make sure he gets all this really great cheese. "And look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them. For Saul and they had all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines." So what did David do? He did exactly what his dad asked him to do. He rose early in the morning. It's possible for a high school student to get up. He did. And it's not 11 o'clock in the morning. What's going on? No, David's up early. He rose early in the morning, left the flock with who? With a keeper. And he took the supplies and he went to Jesse as he had commanded him. So pay attention to the fact that he assigned the flock to a keeper, which tells you David's a good shepherd. Why? Well, he's taking care of the sheep. Not like Saul, who's not a good shepherd. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in a battle array, shouting their war cry. That's when he got there with the food. He's got all these loaves of bread, cheese. He's hauled it down the mountainside. And as he gets there, the army's screaming, "Hoo-ah!" I think it's Hebrew. You have a war cry? I don't think there was any military in the last service. So if you're in the military, you have some kind of war cry, right? Why are you so quiet? Yeah, you have it, right? And it's supposed to build like strength and, you know, courage and everything when you shout it. So the Israeli army is shouting their war cry, whatever it is. But it probably didn't work too well because after they would shout it, then they would run the other direction. And so David gets there right at the time they're shouting the war cry and getting ready to run. What does David do? Well, David, he can't wait to get in on the action. He came to deliver food, and it's like something's going on in the front line, verse 21. And it says, "And Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array against the army, and David left his baggage in the care of a baggage keeper," because he had to haul a lot of stuff with him down the mountainside, "and he ran," notice, he ran to the battle line. So you can imagine, everybody's going the other direction, he's running to the action. He wanted to greet his brothers, and as he was talking to them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines down that mountainside I showed you a few seconds ago. And he spoke these same words of taunting Israel, and David heard them. Not by accident that his mundane job put him in proximity to Goliath, that he can hear this Philistine mocking God. Again, you are not where you are by chance. This leads to a challenge in verses 25 to 31. Who is the tallest person in Israel? Saul. Remember? It says when they chose him as king, why'd they pick him as king? Because we're picking him. All politicians are better if they're tall. They picked, he's head and shoulders over everybody. You kind of have to wonder, why isn't he out on the front line as the tallest guy in Israel, the king, taking on Goliath? Because he is chicken. He's not going to do it. So what did he do? He tried to motivate his troops with a challenge. Here's the challenge, verse 25. "The men of Israel said," as David's listening, "have you seen this man who was coming up, this Goliath guy? Surely he's coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king, Saul, will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and he will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." So here's the deal. You want to go out there and take on this 9-foot-6-inch man, whatever. You want to take him on. If you defeat him, you're going to get wealth beyond your wildest dreams, free taxation. Could you imagine? No tax. And the king's daughter is your new wife. Amazing. Then David spoke to the man who were standing by him, saying, "What? Could you tell me that again? Like, what will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel?" And then notice what he says. He's a teenager. "Who is this, what? Uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" Oh, he's got faith that King Saul did not have. So this little high school student has got greater faith than the king does. And he doesn't call him Goliath from Gath. Because you know, everybody at this point must have known his name because he's shouting it every morning and evening. David doesn't use the name. He just calls him a what? An uncircumcised Philistine. This guy is someone who doesn't know God. Who is he that he should taunt the armies of the living God? And the people answered him in accord with this word, saying, well, thus it will be done for the man who kills him. That's what the king said. You take him out and you get riches beyond your wildest dreams, free taxation, no taxation, and you get a wife. Now, I don't know what his wife looked, what the daughter looked like. It's just a thought. But did anybody take the king up on his deal? So I have thousands of seasoned, hardened warriors. No one does it. Like, it ain't worth it. The guy's he's over 9 feet. He's almost 10 feet tall. No one does it. So David's brother, his oldest brother, Eliab, hears what David is talking about. He hears David's courage. And it says in verse 28, now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the man. And Eliab's anger, which is just unbelievable, burns against David, his youngest brother. And he said to him, to David's face, why'd you come down here? Why'd you come down here? And whom have you left the sheep in the wilderness? Really? You didn't leave anybody in charge for the sheep. They're probably walking all over the place. Dad's lost all of his money. David, you're a lousy shepherd. And I know your insolence and wickedness of your heart. You've come down here in order to see the battle. You're here for all the wrong reasons. Have you ever been trying to do something noble and had somebody really close to you that you thought was walking with you desert you? Have you? I have. It's a very painful thing. Somebody could be somebody in your family that's a Christian. It could be a good Christian friend. And you're doing something for God. And you're following where God is leading. And someone closest to you turns on you. Been there, done that. Jesus said in Matthew 10:36, a man's foes shall be they of his own household. Did you hear me? Boy, how true that is. When you're trying to be noble for God and do a fearless thing for God, and somebody you should be standing with you all of a sudden implodes on you. And then they attack you. And notice, he attacks David with lies. Because who was in charge of the sheep that he left?
A keeper.
So his brother's charge is not even bounded up based on reality. So when you are seeking to do something great for God and you're trying to be a David taking on a Goliath, anticipate people around you that you thought you could lean on turning against you. Just don't allow them to cause you to back up. So if you are the because we've had them in our church, the kind of mother who says, on my watch, they will not teach this in the school systems to my child. I am going to bring this up before the board. I'm going to show courage. And you wondering, what in the world can I do? I'm just a mom. The naysayer among you will tell you, well, you're just the mother. I mean, what can you do? If you're a whistleblower within the government and you know some things that need to be brought forth, but you're like, hey, I'm one guy in a cubicle of thousands of cubicles. What can I do to push back corruption and stuff? And who are you to say anything? But that's what God has placed you there for in your mundane job, to do something great for him. Don't let a naysayer cause you to back up. That was his brother. It says in verse 29, David said to his brother, what have I done now? Was it just a question? I mean, come on, brother. I was just asking an innocent question. Then he turned away from him to another and he said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing as before. Sometimes it's wise to tell the naysayer the truth to their face. Sometimes it's wise to say nothing. And God will give you the wisdom on should you speak or should you not. Since his brother was off the rails, David tells him, hey, out of respect for you as my brother, but what you just said to me is not true. God knows my heart. This leads to what we want to really talk about is the champion of verses 32 and following. It says, David said to Saul, because the word got to Saul about this crazy high school student that wants to take on Goliath. And that's the thing. That's a whole nother side sermon. David's talking about who is this man to defy the armies of the living God. Somebody takes that back to Saul, who's not on the front line. And he's like, I want to talk to this high schooler. Well, bring that teenager here. And so David said to Saul, notice what David says when he gets into his presence. Let no man's heart fail on account of him, of Goliath. Your servant, David, will go and fight with this Philistine. This is amazing. David just acts like the king here. How so? He encourages the king. What should the king have been doing? Encouraging his troops. David just encourages the king and says, don't worry about this man or his stature. I'll take him out for you. Wow. David just did what the king should have been doing. Saul responds with his limited spiritual vision with this. He says to David, he's the glasses half empty guy. You're not able to go out against the Philistine to fight with him. Why? Well, you're just a youth. This guy's been a warrior from his youth. I mean, all you do is take care of sheep. There's no way you can take on a man like this. You think that stopped David? No, no. What we read here is Saul is focused on the outer, the physical, not the inner and the spiritual. What's David focused on? David's focused on just the opposite of that. He's focused on the inner and the spiritual, not the outer and the physical. You have to stop and ask yourself as a side note, as I face my formidable foe, what am I focused on? The living God who's going before me and my faith walk with him? Or am I afraid of what I see on the outside? God says, don't fear, don't fear. Verse 34, David said to Saul, he's going to argue. David was a very good debater. Notice what he says to Saul. He's going to argue from the lesser to the greater. He says, your servant was tending. He said, let me tell you a little story. He said, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and I attacked him and I rescued it, this little lamb, from its mouth. And when he rose up against me, well, I just seized him by the beard and I struck and I killed him. You know, you have to stop and ask yourself, would you do that? I mean, I don't even like, cats kind of bug me. You know, I'm not a cat person. I've had cats, but they just kind of bug me. I mean, a dog will come to you when you whistle and stuff. A cat just like, hey, no way, dude. I'm just, yeah. And then I'm always afraid, like, they're going to scratch me or something. That's a cat. You can imagine that coming at you. And he's got a lamb in its mouth. And it's like, yeah. One of my sheep got eaten by, and it was hanging in the mouth. And I just walked over, grabbed his little beard, pulled it down, bopped him on the head, took the sheep, and then I killed him. Huh? You got to be kidding me. Oh, yeah, and I did it to a bear, too. Do you see the size of the paw? Do you see the size of the paw? Would you want that taking a swipe at you? Would you take that bear and pull on its beard to get a lamb out? I'd be going, oop, lamb's yours. I can buy another one. No, David's like, no, that lamb is mine. It's telling you what kind of king is he going to be. He, like Jesus, the ultimate shepherd, will go out and find a little lamb, and whoever's got him, he'll get him. He said, if I can take out a lion and a bear, what's this beast named Goliath? No problem. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. Just let me at him. Wow. See, David knew that if he showed up on the battlefield to face off against Goliath, he knew that if he stood there against that foe, that God would be with him, going before him. Do you believe that with your life? No matter what your foe is, that you're not alone, God goes before you. Saul says to David, notice what he says. It sounds super spiritual. Go and may the force be with you. It's kind of like that, isn't it? I mean, it's like a Star Wars thing, but it's God. Go and may the Lord Yahweh be with you. So would you say on a scale of 1 to 10, that's like a 10, a spiritual statement? Seems so to me. Is it? No. Well, how do I know? Well, because I kept reading. Because what he does is different than what he just said. He said, Saul then clothed David with his garments and put on a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with his armor. And David girded his sword over his armor, and he tried to walk. Clink, clink, clink. I mean, you got to be kidding me. And David is trying to walk, and who's the tallest guy in Israel? Saul. So you can imagine, David's probably not that tall, wearing massive armor that doesn't even fit him. And David looks at this and goes, I can't go out with these. I mean, I can't even move. I've not tested him. So he took him off. He's like, I got to get back into my tunic. This is ridiculous. And so he's like, street clothes. I don't need armor. Now, you may not understand this as a Westerner, but let me explain to you what's going on here from a Semitic viewpoint. Back at that day and time, if a king gave a warrior his armor and that warrior went out and was successful, the king got the glory. Did you hear me? This is huge. What's Saul doing? May the Lord be with you. And by the way, wear my armor so that if you do happen to kill this guy by chance, I will be glorified among Israel. See? That's why his statement is cheesy. David's like, no, cheesy is a Hebrew term. David's like, I don't want your armor because I'm going to give God the glory. See, when God gives you a victory over your foe, it's not for you to get the glory. It's for God to get the glory. And so David says, take it off. So what did David do? Verse 40, he said he what was his weaponry? He took a what? He took a stick. He took a stick, probably shepherd's rod. He took with him, and he chose for him five stones from the brook, and he put them in a shepherd's bag around his waist that he had, a pouch, and he had a sling in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Now, this is the base of that hill on the north side of the valley. There's a little dry riverbed there, and it's full of stones. And I have a picture of some of the stones that I took in that dry riverbed. So if you're a shepherd with a slingshot, it's easy to find bullets because they're all over the place. Now, I will say as a side note, I've gone to this Valley of Elah for over 25 years. I've been in it many times. And as a former landscaper, I've analyzed the rocks in said riverbed. Because it's like, well, that'd be a great landscape rock. And so I've analyzed them. And what I have found, the last time I was there, I think it was like 2 years ago we were there. I was standing there with my guide, Yaniv, head Navy SEAL trainer, the IDF. Great guy, stud of a guy. And we're standing there, and I told Yaniv, I go, hey, Yaniv, these rocks in the riverbed are different than they were when I was here last time. And they were, different rocks. And there was more of them. And he says, my friend, the Israeli government realizes that Americans will come here and take rocks. And so they just brought a dump truck and dumped them here for you to take. I'm serious. Yeah, and I thought I had the original stones from the time of David. I'm like, serious? I didn't need to know that because I have a bunch of these stones on my desk. I'm just saying. Anyway, back to my sermon. The point being, it's easy to find a stone for your slingshot there, right? And that is kind of funny. Verse 41, the Philistine came and he approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. This guy's probably wore out. Remember, 40 times, twice a day, carrying this massive shield. He's probably dug a huge rut, dragging the shield out there. Finally, look at this little puny Israeli that's coming out here. When the Philistine looked at David and saw him, he disdained him, for he was but a youth. And he disdained him. He was ruddy in appearance and handsome. And the Philistine said to David, this is funny, am I a dog? This is the best you've got? You send out this little chihuahua? And he's carrying a stick? I mean, come on. And so what did the Philistine do? He did what nasty non-Christian people do. He cursed David by the gods. Now, what is interesting, says in verse 44, Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. I mean, you're going to be like a biscuit. I'm going to have you for lunch. So come out here, and you are going to be eaten by the birds of the sky. The buzzards flying around here, they're going to be feasting on you. This is ironic, because he preaches his own judgment out of his own mouth. Does this scare David? No. Verse 45, David said to the Philistine, this is great. He says to him, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin. Big deal. But I come to you in the name of who? The Lord of hosts, the Lord of angelic armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. I'll strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky, to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God, a living God in Israel. And that all this assembly, Israelites, the army, may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or spear. Why? Well, the battle's the Lord's. He will give the enemy into your hand. It's not by your strength and by your power. It's by the Spirit of God. God will empower you. And so he said, I don't care how much heavy armor you have. I don't care how heavy your shield is, your spear. No, God is with me. And he goes forth not with weaponry, but a slingshot and a shepherd's staff. And no armor whatsoever. What do we learn from that passage? I'm going to give you the main idea. What I think is the main idea. Here's the main idea. An uncommon foe calls for uncommon faith in the living God, who will then look for you to give him glory. Did you hear me? An uncommon foe calls for uncommon faith in the living God, who will give you victory and then looks for you to give him the glory. If you are David, you understand the importance of that. What did David do? It says in verse 48, then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David that David did what? He ran quickly toward the battle line. He's the true king to meet the Philistine. He's not afraid at all. Then it says in verse 49, David put his hand in his bag and took from it the stone and slung it. I don't know about you. If I was staring at that giant, I would already have the stone in my sling ready to go as I'm running. He's running toward him. All he's got is the stick. He doesn't even have a stone in the sling. He's got to pull that out on the run as this giant's coming toward him. It says David prevailed. It says he took the stone out of the bag and he slung it. They estimate that this stone, based on the type of a slingshot that they used, would have been traveling around 150 miles an hour. Now, the bigger the man, the bigger the target, right? He might have had a really big head, but there's a whole lot of it exposed. This particular slingshot, you would put a little piece of leather around your finger, put the stone in the middle of it, grab the other end of it with your hand, and then swing it. And then release your finger, and it would release the stone. He must have been a good shot, because he's doing this on the run and hits the guy dead center in the forehead. Hit him in the forehead. It says the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell to his face on the ground. Don't you find this as ironic? Because Dagon fell before the Ark of the Covenant. He did a face plant. Now David, the king of Israel, the true king, wipes out their best warrior with one stone to the forehead, and Goliath does a face plant. It says that David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, and there was no sword in David's hand. Why? Because their army didn't have a lot of swords, because they weren't in on that kind of weaponry, because the Philistines had the corner on how to make iron implements. So what did David do? David ran over and stood over the Philistine and took his sword. This is totally ironic. Takes his sword, drew it out of his sheath and killed him, cut off his head, which is what they did in Semitic warfare, showed total domination to an enemy. Because if you took off the head, you totally owned him. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, what'd they do? They are the ones running back toward Gath. This is mind-boggling. Do you think David's stone was guided there by his expertise? Probably not. I mean, I'm sure it was a good shot, but God guided that stone. God will guide your stone when you deal with evil. Yours might be a logical argument, but God will take your logical argument and use that to wipe out evil. Yours might be a moral stance that you take. God will take that and use that and direct that to be what it needs to be to deal with evil. And this is ironic. I mean, God takes out the largest warrior in their army with a little high school student full of faith. So never underestimate what God can do in and through you, no matter what your age is. The passage ends in what I would call as a charge. And the charge is going to show you that David's courage became the courage of the nation. And the motif is your courage, when you go forth, becomes the courage of those around you who were afraid to act. It says in verse 52, the men of Israel and Judah rose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way to Se'arim, even to Gath, Goliath's hometown, and Ekron. And the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines. They plundered their camps. David took the Philistine's head. He brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapons in his tent. So Jebus, Jerusalem, was not an Israeli capital at this time. It's enemy territory. And what David did is he took the head of Goliath and most likely affixed it to the wall of the city to show total domination, that one day we will defeat this fortress arrayed against God. And then he seizes all the weaponry of Goliath and Goliath's tent as a war trophy to say, look what God has done. But the point being, his bravery caused all the other soldiers to have bravery. You might think you're a nobody and insignificant, but if you step forward and take on your version of a formidable foe, God will go with you and go before you, and he will give you a victory, and you will then inspire other people. What does our nation need? Courageous Christians. That's what it needs. Courageous Christians who are not afraid to, in love, stand up and do what they need to do, knowing God's going to go before them. And when you stand up and are courageous, God's going to give you an army around you of like-minded people who are now inspired. May God bless you as you go forward today. An uncommon foe calls for uncommon faith, in a living God who will give you victory, and then you give him praise. Let's pray. God, thank you for the opportunity to study a great passage. May it not just be information that we have, but information that leads to transformation, and that we stand up and stand up for you, and knowing you're going to be with us and go before us. May there be many Davids in our church body, to your glory. In Christ's name, amen.